Hey there, and thanks for pulling up another edition of On Science, the weekly podcast from the Science Desk at NPR. I'm Andrew Prince. We've got three stories for you this week. We'll learn how a population of nearly extinct Florida panthers is now growing strong thanks to some creative wildlife management. And then it's intrepid science correspondent Joe Palca versus Albert Einstein. Scientists have released new data about Einstein's theory of relativity, and in a lucid 3 minutes and 22 seconds of radio, Joe makes Einstein's landmark theory, one that boggles even the hardiest of scientific minds, perfectly clear. But we'll let you be the judge on that. First up this week, though, we'll talk football and head concussions. Another season is underway, and talk about concussions is everywhere, from the NFL to college to high school on down. Even Congress is interested. A House committee recently had a hearing on how to best safeguard athletes. And then there's this from researchers. A college player who recently committed suicide had a degenerative brain disease normally linked to much older players. And that's prompting a new round of questions about safety in the dangerous game that Americans love. NPR's Tom Goldman has the story.
April 26th, Owen Thomas killed himself, suddenly, impulsively, his family said. According to reports, the burly all-Ivy League defensive lineman, a captain on the University of Pennsylvania football team, didn't leave a note. He was found with his cell phone still in his pocket. Thomas's parents agreed to let researchers at Boston University study Owen's brain. Dr. Robert Cantu is one of the directors at the BU Research Center.
He was 21 years old when he died, and his brain showed what I would call early onset chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
CTE is the football concussion disease of the moment. In the past couple of years, the BU Center has revealed a number of deceased NFL players had CTE. Symptoms include depression, erratic behavior, ultimately dementia. Some killed themselves or exhibited suicidal behavior. Researchers say it's impossible to definitively link Thomas's suicide to CTE, but another aspect of his case was startling. Many of the other CTE victims had a history of repeated documented football-related concussions. Owen Thomas, who started playing as a 9-year-old, didn't. Dr. Cantu.
Thousands of subconcussive blows can probably be just as deleterious as a blow at the concussion level.
Translation? The mere act of playing football with its frequent, seemingly innocuous collisions could be silently wreaking havoc on the brain.
Right. Close your distance down. Go!
Since 2003, Virginia Tech football games and practices like this one have doubled as a brain laboratory for Gunnar Brolinson. He's the team doctor. Using a system that features small sensors in players' helmets and a device on the sideline that receives data from those sensors, Brolinson monitors and records head impacts, small to large. He watches a laptop screen. On it, the shape of a human head. A colored arrow appears on the head.
I'm looking at a head blow right now on one of our players, and I can see that he's had a blow that's on the left lateral side of the head. The length of that arrow corresponds to a blow that is about, let me just bend down here and look at it, it's about a 58G head acceleration.
That's a relatively typical football-related acceleration or impact, says Brolinson. He looks up from the computer screen.
Player looks fine, out there running around.
This HIT system, as it's called, is expensive, $1,000 a helmet. Those who use it have established average counts for head impacts. Linemen, like Owen Thomas, collide every play. They log anywhere from 1,000 to 1,500 head hits per season. But the research, Brolinson says, is very young.
We have no idea if that 1,000 hits is a bad number, and that's the importance of doing this research and carrying it forward.
CTE research also is evolving. Not every football player with lots of head knocks gets it. Indeed, the disease may have a genetic component. Still, Owen Thomas's case has ratcheted up the discussion about how to reduce the number of football head impacts, big and small. In Chapel Hill, North Carolina, longtime football concussion researcher Kevin Guskowitz talks to his 10 and 14-year-old sons. They both play football.
I do ask them every day over dinner, you know, what they went over today, what they learned today, and force them into coming up with at least one or two things that they learn new in terms of how to protect themselves.
Most coaches teach tackling and blocking with the head up. See what you hit is the mantra. The message doesn't always get through. Dr. Guskowitz did a study that showed 1 in 5 college football head impacts happened at the top of the head, alarming to Guskowitz and to Dave Halstead.
I cannot watch a football game where a guy does not lead with his head on almost every play, and that can't be allowed.
Dave Halstead does lab testing on football helmets. He consults with the NFL and Players Union on helmet performance. Safer headgear isn't the issue, though. The best defense, he says, is teaching the game the right way. To make sure all coaches do that and take it seriously, Halstead suggests a rule against any intentional headfirst contact. Then, of course, officials would have to call it when they see it. Getting to that point, says Halstead, will be a challenge.
Because every play, there'd be 27 flags. They're all 15-yard penalties. The field's not big enough.
It should be noted that amidst the outcry about brain injury risk, there was a time when football players died from injuries that now result in concussions. Knowledge, equipment, rules have changed to better protect. There's momentum for a next round of change. For some, it can't come soon enough. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
Life for the world's big cats has become precarious. The number of lions in Africa, tigers in Asia and Russia, and big cats in the Americas is a sliver of what it once was. But one group of big cats is making a comeback, the Florida panther. NPR's Christopher Joyce has this story on an escape from extinction.
Florida panthers are the same species as the western puma, also known as the cougar or the mountain lion. But the panthers are adapted to living in the Florida swamps. By 1995, there were maybe 25 Florida panthers left. Melody Relke, a veterinarian who's tracked them for years, says they were a mess with heart disease or undescended testicles.
The males, with their even a single testis, the quality of that sperm was just abysmal.
They just couldn't reproduce.
We were actually watching extinction process in front of our eyes. And this is what happens with small populations and inbreeding of close relatives.
Relke had waded through swamps and dodged rattlesnakes to follow panthers, but this looked hopeless.
It was devastating. In fact, so devastating, I decided to move to Africa because the battle was over.
But a geneticist who studies big carnivores, Stephen O'Brien of the National Cancer Institute, devised a plan to save the panthers. He combined genetics and math to calculate the panthers' fate.
They were going to go extinct in 25 years with a 99% probability if we left them alone. That's what stimulated the decision to act, to intervene.
He helped convince the federal government to capture 8 female pumas in Texas and release them in Florida to mate with the panthers. Now, that was controversial. The Endangered Species Act said don't mix subspecies. But O'Brien argued that eastern and western pumas had been interbreeding for millennia before highways and housing developments intervened. This would not be a man-made creature. So the Texas cats came to Florida. To see if the plan was working, scientists tracked every panther and its offspring. Relke came back from Africa, now sporting a cheetah scar on her leg, and signed on. She led teams of cat-tracking dogs into the cypress swamps.
They get within less than half a mile of where the cats are, and then the scent is so strong, the dogs are so excited, they just let loose, and they bay, and they start running. The cat then typically will run and jump up a tree.
A marksman would shoot the cat with a dart full of anesthetic.
Then we have a very brave field person who actually climbs up the tree with the cat semi-awake and puts a harness or rope around their chest. And then we lower them into a net.
And then take blood and tissue samples as well as DNA. Before the Texas females arrived, the Florida panthers were, well, pretty lame.
They would be laying there in the tree like, oh, let me die up here, because they just lacked any kind of vigor.
Now, 15 years later, O'Brien says the Florida panther is a new cat.
I think we can say cautiously that it was the right decision. The population increased in number threefold. The admixture cats, which are hybrids, are much stronger and more robust, and they look a little bit like Arnold Schwarzenegger version of cats.
Writing in the journal Science, O'Brien says the animal's DNA shows that the hybrids are the healthiest of the litter. Craig Packer, an ecologist at the University of Minnesota who's worked with lions in Africa, says the project is a textbook case of how dangerous inbreeding can be, even in wild animals.
The importance of this study is to really emphasize not only that this population really did suffer substantial costs of inbreeding, but that it was relatively easy to resolve by bringing in a small number of new animals to the population.
Packer says introducing new genes raises the chances that an isolated group can resist novel diseases or genetic defects. He says it could help keep other big cats, lions in Africa and tigers in Asia, from going extinct. But the Florida panthers aren't out of the woods yet. O'Brien says 100 panthers isn't quite enough to stop inbreeding altogether. On the other hand, more panthers means they will literally be out of the woods.
A lot of people don't want to have cougars in their backyard when they're raising their kids and their little dogs. And I think that this is a reasonable fear.
O'Brien says the solution is to find some new homes for the rejuvenated panthers. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
And finally this week, relativity. Everyone has had the experience of time seeming to slow down. Just ask any third grader waiting for the final bell on that last day of school. But Einstein's theory of relativity says time really can slow down. And now, scientists have measured these time changes in our everyday lives. NPR's Joe Palca has the story.
Before we talk about the new results, we first have to talk about the nature of time. It's hard to think of time as something that varies.
It's just so counterintuitive to our everyday lives.
Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist at Caltech in Pasadena.
The miracle is that Einstein's way of thinking about it wasn't forced by some dramatic experiment that anyone did. It was really just pure thought.
The pure thought led Einstein to the conclusion that light, not time, was the constant. It doesn't matter if you're standing still or traveling on a rocket ship, if you turn on a light and measure its speed, it will always be the same. But if that's true, it leads you to the inevitable conclusion that time has to be flexible.
And this is something that people have difficulty wrapping their minds around because it doesn't show up in any obvious way in our everyday lives. It's a very, very subtle effect until you're flying close to a black hole or moving close to the speed of light.
To demonstrate this effect, I've asked my colleague David Green to take a little trip on the NPR spaceship. And unlike the clunkers that NASA flies, NPR's special spaceship can travel close to the speed of light. I asked David to take a clock with him and record a greeting when he was about 86% of the speed of light.
Hi, Joe. How you doing?
That's how David would sound if I were standing next to him on the rocket ship. But if I were able to listen to him from here on Earth, this is how he would sound.
Hi, Joe. How you doing?
To me, his time would have slowed down. That's what part of the theory of relativity predicts. But Einstein realized there was more to it.
He realized that not only does the amount of time you experience depend on how fast you move and how much you accelerate, it also depends on your gravitational field, how deeply you're embedded in a gravitational field.
The closer you are to a massive gravitational field like the Earth, the more the slowing of time. So time moves faster for someone sitting on the top of a flagpole compared to someone sitting on the ground, because the top of the flagpole is farther from the mass of the Earth, and therefore experiences less pull from gravity. And now, finally, we're ready to talk about the new results. Using extremely accurate clocks, scientists at the National Institute of Standards and Technology in Boulder were able to measure these tiny changes in time caused by movement and gravity, not in imaginary spaceships, but in their lab in Colorado.
But what these guys are able to do is just to measure that to absolutely unprecedented accuracy and precision. So they're really driving home the fact that a clock moves faster on the second floor of your house than on the first floor.
Physicist James Chinwon Chow is one of those guys. As he reports in the journal Science, a clock moving at about 20 miles per hour ticks a tiny fraction of a second slower than a stationary clock. A really tiny fraction.
0.0, and then there will be 17 zero, and then some number after the 17 zero.
James Chinwon Chow is as interested in designing extremely precise clocks as he is in relativity. His latest clock uses the vibrations of an aluminum atom missing an electron to measure time. And as Einstein's work suggests, getting time exactly right is trickier than you might think. By the way, David Green made it safely back to Earth. Thanks for helping out, David.
It's a pleasure, Joe. Thanks for the trip.
Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
And that's it for this week's edition of On Science. You can find all these stories and all the stories from NPR Science at our website. That's npr.org/science. I'm Andrew Prince.